I chuckle every time I read a large carrier has decided that they're wasting time with prior authorization. Hey, look, it's probably important to look at what people are doing and making sure that folks are getting the right kind of medicine.
Hello, and welcome to HIMSCast. I'm Susan Morse, Executive Editor of Healthcare Finance News. We are talking today about direct-to-employer healthcare, and we are here with Jaja, who is CEO of First Choice Health. Jaja, can you first start by introducing yourself, please, and talking about First Choice?
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me. I am currently the President and CEO of First Choice Health. I have been in my role for about 6 years, although I've been in healthcare for over 30. I've had a chance to be a consultant. I worked for Deloitte in their healthcare strategy department. I worked for McKesson for a number of years and spent quite a while at Blue Cross Blue Shield plan. So I've seen different aspects of healthcare from different areas.
Well, that's fascinating that you've been at Deloitte, McKesson, Blue Cross, so you have the gambit of experience, which I would love to tap into today. First of all, Jaja, can you say your full name, please?
Jaja Okigwe.
Okigwe, thank you. I want to know, what does First Choice Health do?
Yeah, so First Choice Health is probably one of the few remaining provider-owned ventures from about 30 years ago. It was created by hospitals and physicians to really be an alternative to traditional health insurance. And so what does that mean? Well, first it was, hey, let's figure out a way to create a network and provide pricing and experience that was easier to deal with, more straightforward and simpler. Along the way, we launched a health plan and eventually turned that into self-funding, third-party administration. We do medical management, so oversight of claims. We do case management, so helping people figure out where to go post pre and post surgery. And then we have an employee assistance program. Mostly what we're doing right now is working with health systems and providers, so physicians, who are interested in working directly with employers. Directly in the sense of wanting to own more of their relationship than having to go through a Blue Cross Blue Shield or an Aetna, Cigna, United.
I wonder if we can dive into that a little bit more, because we've heard a lot lately about direct-to-employer health plans and healthcare. What exactly does that mean? Do you avoid the insurance industry altogether? Are they the administrator, as they are with a lot of large companies? How does that work, please?
Yeah, there's a lot of different people that are doing it. I think we're seeing it right now because many hospitals and physicians have realized there's another way for them to get patients and to get paid for seeing patients. And that really is working largely with an employer and saying, hey, I want to help you take care of your employee population. I want to do that in a way that removes a lot of the sort of give and take, the paperwork, the access issues, and I want to customize programs for you so that you're getting the care that you actually need instead of big generic programs that you purchase from a big box. So in many ways, it's more of a customized program, and I think that's where the enticement comes in. For providers, the excitement is the fact that they don't have to figure out the financing constantly, or for that matter, lose their patients because they're out of network for that particular health plan.
Interesting. How does it work? Do they pay a flat fee? Is it a capitated amount? Because I know we're also talking about value-based care here.
Yeah, so it the financing is pretty much the same way that a standard health plan works. Most employees won't really know the difference other than they'll start to receive information suggesting where to go for care. The products are super similar. Often there's an administrator like First Choice sitting in the background. There are ID cards, just like a standard program. So generally speaking, people aren't much the wiser, other than all of a sudden, it seems a little bit easier to get things done.
It's easier. Why is that?
Well, for The way that we work, we tend to try to make sure that we can eliminate some of the policies and procedures that slow things down. There's a ton of stuff around prior authorization right now, where, and I chuckle every time I read a large carrier has decided that they're wasting time with prior authorization. Hey, look, it's probably important to look at what people are doing and making sure that folks are getting the right kind of medicine. But we've been doing that for years, and we've been able to eliminate a lot of steps along the way. So these relationships allow you to actually go to your doctor, get a diagnosis, and sign up for surgery without necessarily tons of steps in between.
So there's no prior authorization process, or is it just smoother?
It's smoother, and it's probably fewer. That's generally what we've seen. Here's my quick commercial, which I hesitate to throw out there for first choice, but we have a tendency to see what people are requesting and call up the provider to work through whatever information's missing to make sure that we can approve. The standard brand X version of that is to deny the authorization and wait for things to be submitted. So that's just an example of how we can really just shortcut. If this is a required surgery, it's really needed. Just because you forgot to send us something shouldn't be a means to delay it for 2 to 3 weeks.
Or even longer, from what I'm hearing.
Or longer.
Yeah, prior authorization is the big bad wolf out there.
Right.
Not suddenly, but it's, as you said, been getting a lot of news lately. Why aren't more providers, payers doing this then? What's happening out there?
Well, for the last few years, they've been dealing with the after effect of COVID. Huge financial crisis for many hospitals. I think they're hopefully just starting to come out of it in many places, although in the West, we're still feeling it pretty severely. And that's made people much more focused on things they need to do to stay healthy right now. These programs are a little more strategic. They require some setup to get going. But we have seen a lot more people put it back on the agenda for 24. So very excited about the opportunity to bring it to more markets.
So you're growing then. You see this as a growing market.
Yeah, we are growing.
Yeah, excellent. And how is this tied to value-based contracts?
So value-based contracts, of course, one way to get paid. The idea that rather than getting paid per service, that you're getting paid in some ways for generally taking care of a population. There's some bonuses that can be in there. Or it can go all the way to, hey, I'm going to pay you a flat fee. You figure out what you have to do and make sure that it works out for you. To me, for most providers, the goal would be to get to being able to just be paid a flat fee and manage patients. But sometimes you don't have enough visibility or enough population or enough geography. These programs help you get more of that, if that makes sense. So you can cover a greater area, you can get more patients, and it makes it easier for you to take risk.
Then how is this model different than, say, Medicare Advantage, where they do get paid a flat fee for their members?
Well, this model could look very similar, although Medicare Advantage doesn't pay at the same rates as commercial.
Right.
But it could look very similar to some of the things that people are doing through ACOs or through Medicare Advantage.
Okay. Is this an ACO
I struggle to use that particular term because Medicare's made it very, very specific. The organizations that we work with sometimes are also ACOs. Sometimes they are clinically integrated networks, so they're sharing information and resource. And sometimes they're just literally a network of providers who've come together saying, we want to do it this way.
Got it. CMS just released, well, not just a little while ago, a prior authorization rule. How does that apply to what you're doing into the contracts you have?
Yeah, so for many providers, Medicare and Medicaid are really big parts of their business. So when CMS produces a rule, they would like it to be the same across everything. So we usually wind up taking a hard look. There's a lot of skepticism with prior auth and making sure that it's needed. What I see us saying is we need to continue to adapt and make more changes to make that process make sense. I also don't see them saying you need to get rid of all controls. There are probably some places where having a second look is important, and there are different ways to do that.
Is there risk involved in these contracts? Is there a downside risk?
We have one relationship that has both upside and downside risk, and has put in place these direct employer relationships. Most of them are somewhere between that and fee for service. But I think the larger it gets, the easier it is to go to full risk.
Now, I know you're involved with employer contracts, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about commercial insurance rather than Medicare and Medicaid. Is that correct, Joshua?
That's correct. Yeah.
Where do you see this trend going? As far as direct to employer, what do you see as the future? Is there a downside to this?
So first part of that, where do I see it going? I think there are more hospitals and more physician groups that will be involved in this type of arrangement going forward, and in parts of the country that many people don't anticipate, right? Our most active conversations are in the middle of the country, not necessarily in the big urban population centers. And why is that? They're looking for new ways to do business and ways to make their business more stable. The downside to me is that there are probably some markets that are going to try it out that it's not really appropriate for. Really, really small populations, meaning they don't have a lot of local employers. They're fairly rural. We've been trying to figure out how do we make this work there, and haven't come up with a slam dunk solution. But I think for many, many, many parts of the country, this is something that would be pretty promising.
So you're in the middle part of the country, which is considered rural
yeah.
compared
yeah,
to the
yeah.
East and West Coast,
yeah.
and maybe some other areas, but it can't be too rural.
That's
what
exactly
you're
what
saying.
I'm saying. Yeah.
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 So we've been hearing more about smaller hospitals coming together for more
Mm-hmm.
clout and sharing technology and resources. Would you be able to work with a collaborative like that?
Absolutely. And we are talking to some of the rural hospital associations about, could this kind of a model work if a bunch of them were together? You know, my biggest fear is there are some very small communities who are struggling to maintain their local healthcare. And I don't know that this is the solution for that, but a larger group, maybe. Maybe there's a way in which it could work across a bunch of communities together.
Okay. Before we go, I just want to be clear about what First Choice is offering. So if you can tell me and make sure I've got this correctly. So you're an administrator, in a way,
yes, we are. Yeah.
of the benefits. As an employee, I don't see any difference. I have the card in my wallet, the same as I would for any insurance. When I go to a provider, am I in a limited network?
Limited in the sense that there are some places that would be out of network. Yeah. Different than today.
Than any plan where you have in network and out of network, unless you're paying
yeah.
more, I guess, for a PPO. Is that what they are? That
yeah.
So
these are typically, they'll look like a PPO for most people. The one difference often is that your best benefit, right? So your best benefit is for a smaller group that's usually the sponsor of
okay.
what we're doing. Yeah.
Got it. And if I'm an employer, what's your selling point of go with me rather than the bigger insurers?
Well, yesterday it was, hey, you have people mostly local who are going to work in person, and you're paying for something that has you with network that's gigantic and that has an undifferentiated benefit. Wouldn't you like to have something that's a lot more simple, a chance to customize to your population and meet some of the needs that they have that allows for easier access, and it's going to reduce your cost? If that sounds too good to be true, then let's run the numbers for you and actually show you how it works. The one difference today from that first pitch is that many, many employers, even the ones in the middle of the country, now have employees in places they never thought of before.
True.
And so we've had to talk a little bit about how do you make this work if 90% of your people are in, I don't know, in Wyoming, and you've got 10% suddenly in Virginia? And so that's a little bit more difficult, but we're starting to create relationships across markets to be able to answer that question.
Is this another outcome of COVID, of people working at home or wherever they want? And boy, Virginia is a lot warmer maybe than someplace up north.
We had employees ourselves in four states before COVID, and now we have employees in 15. So that changes your benefits. You wake up one day thinking that they're designed on one location and you realize, oh, I've got people that are in Texas now. What am I going to do about that?
Excellent. Thank you so much, Jaja. It's another way where we've all had to be flexible and change our way of thinking since COVID. This has been a great pleasure speaking with you and learning about this. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.